This podcast is supported by Siemens, your partner for industrial-grade AI.
Hi there, welcome to a new episode of the Industrial AI Podcast. My name is Peter Seeberg and I'm your host. Today I'm going to be talking to Bernhard Kratzwald. He's the co-founder CTO at Ethan AI. And Ben and I are going to be talking about machines understanding their own mistakes. Hi, Bernhard.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Let's start, as we always do, with you maybe introducing yourself to our listeners, please.
Yeah, sure. So hello, my name is Bernhard. I'm a co-founder of Ethan. And my background in computer science, I studied originally at ETH in Zurich, where we spin off the company from. That was about 4 years ago. Now we are working globally. I'm just recently relocated to New York, and we basically solve a problem that likely feels very familiar to many of you, like small process deviations turn into multi-million dollar losses before teams can see or control them. And we are helping global companies, basically like Siemens, Lindt, Roche, Bosch, to understand these process deviations, control them, and save a lot of money.
And that's exactly what we're going to be talking about. A Swiss in New York, not an Englishman in New York, of which we know the famous music.
Yeah. Exactly.
Bernhard, looking forward to... Yeah, well, let me start with congratulating you again with the Siemens Inventors of the Year 2025 award.
Thank you. I think it was really great. Siemens is one of our oldest customers. We started actually as research partners. Then they were one of our first customers. We scaled globally with them first. And then now we are even a partner where we are selling software together. So I think it's one of the really examples to show how scale-ups and big conglomerates can work together and benefit from each other.
And the award, the Inventors Award, was exactly about what it is we're talking about, or was there something specific about it?
I mean, so we got the recent award, for instance, also from the World Economic Forum for being one of the first AI solutions that scales globally within a big company like Siemens. And Siemens every year gives out this Inventor of the Year awards, of which I think four or five are internally and two are externally for companies and research partners. And we, for the same reason, got the external one for the best scale-up collaboration within Siemens.
Okay, enough about Siemens. As you and as our listeners know, Siemens happens to be our podcast partner, but that is not the reason that we talk, as those listeners of you that have been with us for many, many years know we go for the content. And that's why maybe you want to tell us a little bit more, starting about your company, Ethan AI, please, Bernhard.
Yes, of course. What we do at Ethan is basically we read in all the types of data that manufacturing companies have out there. So MES data, data from historians and other sources. Then we contextualize that data with a knowledge graph, and then we can explain causal relationships in that data. So what drives your quality? What drives the uptime of your machine? What drives the stability of your process? And then we can use these insights again to basically improve the process, to fix it, to make it better. So it's kind of a row of first we measure, then you understand, then you improve, and then you control the process. So it's a full operational workflow end to end. And it starts from detecting defects with visual inspection to root cause analysis to process optimization to process control, all these things.
Right, that's all some of the details we're going to get into a little bit more later on. Specifically, the causal AI, I'm very much interested in. Now, where I was reading about what it is that you're doing, there was the claim, I'm not sure it's yours, but it's about the machines understanding their own mistakes, which, of course, is a claim. And I saw not only, again, Siemens, all you mentioned Bosch, all the other companies, think Hannover Messe is starting today when we are recording. How do you feel yourself about that claim of the understanding if you combine that in combination with the knowledge? Again, another word that typically until a couple of years has been exclusively used for humans. Knowledge graph, causal understanding. Is that a thing? Well, do you say, sure, maybe a couple of years ago it was a hype, but it's getting closer to what we call understanding. Is that what machines are doing today?
I think we are really shifting from just being reactive to fully understanding things. I can give you an example. Like a situation everyone is familiar with is you have the same production line, the same recipe, two different days, and the outcome is completely different. On day one, everything runs well. On the second day, there is an issue and your output is not there. You have a bad first pass yield. You have a machine downtime, all these things, right? In manufacturing, variation is normal. But the real cost isn't the variation itself. It's the time we spend not understanding it. And I think that's to connect it with that knowledge and causal keywords that we had before. I can give you a very concrete example. For instance, you know that the month of the year will impact your, let's say, quality of the process. So your production runs better in summer and worse in winter. That's a correlation. And that's not really insightful because you have to run your production for the full year, right? You can't just say, oh, in winter I shut down. If you have a causal system where machines really understand each other and the system understands why your quality drops, then you will understand that in winter, for instance, the cooling water temperature might be lower than in summer, and that affects your cooling system. And suddenly, when you know that, you have something that is actionable that you can act on, because then you can just adjust the cooling time of a batch, for instance, in the winter months, and you will have a better quality all year long. So that's what we mean with just understanding it. These variations are normal. They're out there. You have different machines, different raw materials. Everything ages differently. These variations will always be out there. The real leverage is in understanding them quickly and making them actionable.
Right. Now, in the past, I've been talking about the pillars of, at that time, many, many years ago, we talked about machine learning. In the meantime, it's Gen AI, AI. We come to correlations, to causal AI later on. I do believe maybe, but you can tell me that the pillars are maybe still very much the same, which is basically algorithms. We need algorithms, we need data. And there's a third one, which I forgot for a moment. But I was going to ask you about the data. Typically, still, that's one of our major problems, not always getting the data that we need. Or maybe then you get to your customers or to your partners and they say, oh, we have all this data, but then maybe still you can't use it. Tell us a little bit about your experience about the availability of, in this case, I guess, specifically industrial data.
Yeah, of course. I mean, as you said it correctly, I feel like everyone is a bit scared that they have too little data available. But when you actually talk with bigger companies, it turns out that very often the opposite is the case, that you have a lot of data, but it's not accessible to you on your fingertips, right? So you have an issue today, and then you will want to have this data available to you to figure out why this is happening. And then you first need to call your data scientists, your entire, task force team, and they have 17 other fires to distinguish at the same time. So I think the real benefit comes from, can you connect all these systems, all these SCADA historians, MES systems out there to a global platform that truly understands your data? And that's where the knowledge graph comes in. So when you have a quality defect today, you know which data belongs to that quality defect, which machines this product ran through, at what timestamps, which events were recorded there. And you can, at your fingertips, say, I want to start an analysis right now because I don't know why this happened. And then you get an insight without asking a data scientist. Like, you want to give these insights to the operators and to the process engineers.
Sure. So let's stay with this, which I believe is a huge topic here. I was going to ask it at a higher level, because all the time still we hear about the silos of the data, and we still have all the different protocols, and some of them MQTT, and then there's OPCUA and information models, and there's a lot of discussion still always continuously going on before we then come to the doing the real thing. But it's, I hear that your approach is, or your solution, your approach is with the knowledge graph. Tell us a little bit about the knowledge graph. What is a knowledge graph, and how do you go about dealing with that knowledge graph?
So a knowledge graph basically is just a set of two objects and how they relate with each other, right? You can say this parameter belongs to this machine. This machine is part of this production line. And if you do that, then suddenly the data that might be in your silos gets connected by this ontology, by this knowledge graph, and it suddenly gets meaning. So, you know, if a product failed at the end of the production line, I know in which machines it has been, at what timestamps, then I can also get the data of that machine, then I can basically link that all together dynamically. And that's basically the entire concept of a knowledge graph. It's a bit like some people would say almost a digital twin of your factory. You just want to say which data comes from where and where does it go to.
Now, who makes the knowledge graph? Who is a knowledge graph person? Do you need a specific education for that? Are they people that have typically been doing XYZ? Do you have many of them? At the end, we come to your team and we get a maybe a better understanding. But I mean, what is the, let's say, the percentage maybe? Is the knowledge graph person doing 5 or 10% of a complete job maybe until it's being rolled out? Or how, what is the feeling?
So for our customers, they don't even realize that they're building a knowledge graph, right? You have a user interface where you can like link your equipment together. You can say which tag comes from what equipment, what's the order that these equipments run through. Customers can put in knowledge fact in our system, or when they run an analysis and something pops up, this can be stored as a new knowledge fact. So it's more like an interactive user experience.
I'm with you. As you can hear, it's a topic that I've been close to for a long time, but then I had a feeling it was gone again, kind of, and at least I do not have this. There's a huge number of people, of big supporters, so to say. So I'm just going to ask you one more question. Are there general knowledge graph tools in the market, or should I understand that what you build a user interface, and behind it, what people do indirectly is building a knowledge graph, is what I hear you say. So you provided a system which in the end builds a knowledge graph, is that right?
Yes, exactly. That is correct. So our system implicitly builds a knowledge graph. There are also systems out there on the market that just build a knowledge graph, but then obviously you will still need the applications on top that give you value out of that knowledge graph. And for me, a knowledge graph is very similar to data itself. It will never be done, it will never be complete, and you can never have enough there. So if you start with collecting data, same as if you start with building a knowledge graph, you will always need to connect it to some application that brings value to you, for you to know when you have done enough, because you can obviously, at one point, you will just not get any marginal gains out of getting more knowledge in your knowledge graph. So I think it's always very important when we do data science or AI, can we connect every system directly to an output and then iterate on getting it better and better.
Very good. Then I'm going to ask you, what is a typical output mean that you run into, or to put it differently, which are the typical questions that you or your customer would like to ask from the industrial data, from the knowledge graph? I mean, knowing what it is that you're going to be working with, that kind of leads you to what it is, the relations that it is you always need to have. So a couple of months later, you can start asking questions regarding those relations, or?
Yeah, exactly. So usually questions our customers would ask is, what drives quality in my factory? What was responsible for an incident I had today? More dynamic versions of center lining. Sometimes customers manufacture 200, 600 SKUs, and then basically they just have two or three general set points for families of these. Now with more modern systems, you can get down to like more dynamic centerlining recommendations for each of these SKUs. And then the ultimate goal for many obviously is autonomous process control. But I think that's a more like of a journey of maturity where you start with better centerlining and then go to more autonomous process control later on.
We'll keep that to the end when you're going to share an outlook with us if we're going to go there or not. Now, so you built this AI software platform. I believe we already heard one key element of that platform then, the knowledge graph. The other element maybe, and maybe you can talk a little bit about that, is we heard you say already a correlation. Now, most of you have heard me say in the past already, correlation does not equal causation. Some of us have had, you know, maybe university somewhere, this famous quote, I believe. Now, when I was preparing, I saw that, you know, going for causation is one, I believe, very important element of your solution. Tell us, what is the difference between correlation and causation, and what is it exactly that you're doing with both of them?
There is this famous example, right, where I can say that in summer, basically, ice cream sales and shark attacks are higher. So you can say higher sales of ice cream right. has an impact on shark attacks, right? That would be a correlation. They're just yeah. both going up at the same time. And it's a good example, but there's the problem is that what you don't yeah, see is that is, for yeah. both, actually, the heat is responsible, and the heat makes people eat more ice cream and go more in the water, so more people are attacked by sharks. That's very obvious, this example, right? But now when you go to a factory and you have thousands, 10,000s of process parameters that you measure, there are things showing up that are perfectly correlated. And it's very hard then to determine, well, which of these impacts actually has a causal impact on your quality. And that's really what causal AI does. It's something coming from medicine where you're trying to figure out what kind of intervention. So did the pill I gave a patient cure the patient, or was it just the good weather outside, right? And a process on the shop floor is nothing else than a patient that is either sick or healthy. One day it runs very healthy, the next day the process runs a bit sick, and then your process engineers and your operators come with all their knowledge and try to make the patient healthy again. And now when you record all of that in your data, you can figure out what the intervention actually made the patient healthy again.
Very good. And thank you for sharing this wonderful example. And that brought my brain to this wonderful book. None of you know it. I think it's called Spurious. Is that a word? Spurious correlations?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
For those of you listeners interested, there's hundreds of these great correlations which do not stand in a causal relationship. Good. Thanks for them. Now, next to, I think, so we talked maybe two or three elements. What are the other maybe three key technologies that you use transforming the unused production data into this actionable knowledge?
I think one of the key pillars is a computer vision. So for us, it is very essential that we have our own visual inspection solution in our platform that allows our customers to automatically identify visual anomalies or defects into their product. Like in many industries, you still measure waste by kilograms per shift. And obviously that signal is way too weak to ever put autonomous process control in front. Like you need to have something, some signal that in real time tells you now your quality goes up and down to basically steer against it, right? If you just say 8 hours later, I had to throw away half my product, then that's a bit too late. So computer vision is definitely one of our foundations.
Which means then, so a computer vision equals a camera plus then algorithms?
Yeah, so we provide the algorithms and the software, and our right. customers provide the okay. cameras. So you can just plug okay. in any okay. industrial camera with our software and it will run.
Okay.
And then, yeah, anomaly detection and process mining, I think, are two more foundations we have woven into our platform to understand a bit how products move and flag deviations in time series before they basically reach the customer through other channels.
Is process mining another specific approach that you may want to share a little bit about? I mean, I've been looking into the process mining for several times, but I'm still not sure that it's very interesting to hear that you're using it, and I would like to know how you're using it. And is typically the process mining, is that a way to move from correlation to causation? Maybe is that a way of really finding out where the problem in the process is, or are they completely separate approaches?
I mean, for us, the process mining is a bit more of a, I would say, transparency tool. So you want to, if you have a specific event that you're investigating, you want to see how did my units move around that time. Can I create the digital value stream map that I can now just create with a press of a button instead of making someone with a stopwatch run along a production line and figuring out the individual attack types of my machines. So it's a bit more of a, I would say, transparency tool that in itself can be very powerful. But behind the user interface, there's very little AI when it comes to process mining. It's really just making that data very available and visible to the customer.
Right. It's more like a classical algorithmic approach, I understand, right? Very good. Tell us about your system behaving like a digital quality engineer. That's a quote I saw somewhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, The thing is, when we started our company, Gen AI was very trending, right? I did my PhD on Gen AI a while ago, but it was not on the level that it was like today. So we have built all these foundations of causal models, of models for autonomous process control that are safe to use in industrial applications. So it's not like send your data to ChatGPT and tell me how to fix my machine, but there's really a deep foundational causal model at the backbone that helps manufacturers to adjust these machines. What we can use Gen AI and LLMs now for is to build agents on top of that technology. And I think that's really where the magic comes into place, because in the first versions of our platform, you had to go into the monitoring, figure out that your quality dropped, and manually kick off an analysis and then try to interpret that analysis. What we can do now, because we basically have this foundational model of our own industry-safe models, is you can have your own agent starting a workflow. When it realizes that your quality drops, it automatically starts an analysis for our MCP. It gets the analysis results back. It merges that with user manuals, process descriptions, standard operating procedures that you have in the system. And then it explains to you why this happened. So basically, when you start your shift, you already have a full rundown of what happened since you were absent and what are potential fixes for it. And that just gives you like a really an automated quality engineer that helps you to do your job better.
Why don't you share maybe a little bit more detail, an example? I saw somewhere an example of a chocolate factory. Not sure if that's a correlation, as you being a Swiss, and Swiss for one reason being known for a very high quality chocolate. Can you share what is happening in a chocolate factory, and how would a user, and we'll come to that user later on, or maybe you want to share as immediately, what is that user, how would they recognize what is happening, and how would they go about solving the problem?
Yeah, sure. I mean, a chocolate is just such a great example. It's so visual. Everyone can imagine it well. We are working with Linden Springli, the Swiss premium. Yeah. Swiss premium chocolate.
Just to give one example, which is, if you haven't tried it yet, it's the best available, I believe, but there you go.
Yeah, exactly. No, they're really a great customer, also basically customer since day one. And we are working with them globally now. What you do in chocolate is in all these processing steps from the raw ingredients you have to the final product, there is some process steps that are definitely a bit more complex when you create, for instance, chocolate balls and then you try and fill them. And there's a lot of fluctuations from raw material, outside weather, air temperature, etc. So it's not always clear when something happens why this is happening, and then that leads to obviously unstable processes. And with our software, we help companies like Lint and Springly to correct for them in a very automated fashion.
So what is that typical user? Is that maybe you already talked about, you started like without, or if you wanted to do things, maybe in the future you're going to have agents do that. But what is today the typical user? And maybe if you compare that with, you know, the same factory running 10, 20 years ago, what is the different skills this person is bringing? Maybe today it is still the same person, but let's say if tomorrow the young person is going to take over that job, what is the different skills the person need, and what is a different way they deal with the system?
Yeah, sure. So I think from the user perspective is we almost always start with subject matter experts, process engineers, or line managers. And then we really try to move as fast as we can towards operators. So first you want to get the process as stable as possible, and then you want to get the running of the process as stable as possible. I mean, what changed? I think a lot of things changed because obviously, like much troubleshooting in manufacturing is up to date still. You know, you have a problem with a machine and you go out there and you watch the machine and you listen to the machine and you try and see what is happening there. And then you try and fix it. And I think it in both directions, right? We can't think that AI will ever take that away completely. Like there are machines out there that are 20 years old. Sometimes you just have to go out there and see, I don't know, there is a cylinder in this machine that is broken or something else. And at the same time, I think you cannot just rely on that your experience and gut feeling will give you the right answer in the fastest way always. So I think it's truly enabling and augmenting process experts with AI where the secret sauce is for the future.
I guess, yeah, my question was implying some kind of hypothesis that, yes, the exact example of the person who's been on the shop floor 40 years and puts his or her hand on, you know, whatever piece of equipment and because of the way it vibrates, knows exactly what is broken inside. And of course, you're not going to get that from the beginning, but maybe the assumption or the question would be that as you start recognizing in your algorithms causal relationships, as the way you do it, between exactly that specific quality of the vibration and what is broken, maybe the young person, as the example, is gonna maybe not be holding that machine with their hand in the future, but they're gonna learn it through the AI. Is the question?
No, 100%. They're gonna learn it through the AI, and I think they're gonna be targeted much more efficiently by the AI. They might be told, go to this machine, have a look at cavity 7. I think something with the tool is off there. And they will go there and immediately spot the problem and be able to fix it instead of first having to, you know, monitor the process for a day and then doing a 5Y analysis, boiling it down until they find the problem. It would just be a bit like, yeah, to say that AI is solving all the problems in manufacturing, I think we are a bit away from that because some production lines are also just like, you know, 30 years old and they will stay old for a while. And so I think the AI will make our life much more efficient on some lines and much more autonomous on other lines. And it will depend on the data availability, the age of the line, etc.
Very good. Let's talk about a typical implementation, maybe. I'm not sure what example you want to. Maybe there's different categories of, you know, market segments. Maybe you want to share that with us as well. You know, we heard chocolate as an example. Is discrete typically where you work? Is process? Chocolate starts as a process, maybe, I don't know, and then in the end turns out to become discrete. So maybe you want to tell us about that, and also talk about if you then come, or your customers, You know, what is the time frame? What is the different steps that you go through with them before they then start working with your solution?
Sure. So our core verticals are definitely consumer packaged goods, food industries, chemicals, and then in the discrete space, just anything with mechanics and electronics like Siemens, Bosch, and other similar companies. So we are working quite industry agnostic by the names of these verticals. And how we basically engage with our customers, it's a very deployment heavy motion. We really like to spend on-site time with our customers. So usually during the first 3 months of onboarding, we come on-site at least twice for almost a week to do the data pipelining, data integration, and then basically user training and help with the change management, right? I think we touched it briefly before. Processes are changing, workflows are changing. And it's impossible to do that in a remote context. You need to see how basically operators are operating today and then figure out how you can help them get more up to speed with more modern workflows. And that's why we spent a lot of time on site with usually 1 to 2 people.
Okay. You mentioned at the very beginning that you are part of the Siemens Accelerator Marketplace. And you also mentioned the World Economic Forum Minds program. Share 1-2 lines with us what that means for a company as you started. What do those kind of organizations, how do they help you come to market?
Yeah, of course. The Minds program of the World Economic Forum selects industry collaborations with scale-ups, for instance, where they see AI applications really reach a global scale. That's what we did with Siemens, where our solution is used in factories in Asia, in Europe, and in the Americas. And we published a white paper there together with Siemens, where we said we would save about $10 million annually. So I think that was one of the great visibilities of the collaboration with Siemens. And then, as I mentioned before, Siemens was a customer, a research partner, and now we are also going towards partners. So offering our software within the Siemens universe on, for instance, the Siemens Accelerator Marketplace to also bring out partnering offerings where our solution then works together with Siemens software.
Bernard, you already shared 1 or 2 kind of thoughts. You refer to agents. You suggested if not, we're going to be moving towards autonomous manufacturing. Where do you see the market moving? And specifically also, as I said, as a Swiss in New York, the global perspective, where do you see Europe? Where do you see the United States? Where do you see Asia? Just as you started and are rolling out your solution on a global level, where are things moving towards?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there are a few trends that I'm currently seeing. It's on the one hand, we are moving a bit from assisted agentic workflows to fully autonomous agentic workflows. So for the first time, we are seeing agents not just being collaborating with humans on the shop floor, but AI applications actually running the process. This is, I think, quite new for many. And this is definitely a trend that I would expect to really get much deeper over the next years. I think another thing that we are seeing now with our customers that are using really multiple factories, across different continents, is we are seeing really heavy improvements from cross-factory intelligence. So bringing people together, speaking about the same names, making people from different factories learn from each other, and then ultimately making the AI work from insights in different factories. That's a huge value unlock for our customers. And then I think the last thing is that we will see the workforce transformation. So closing the skill gap with this AI technology, we will really see that you will be in 5 years able to onboard anyone to run your shop floor operations basically without any major onboarding steps. And with AI assisted workflows, it will be possible.
Very good. Do robots play a role? And if so, are they, the typical industrial robots that have moved towards cobots in the last 10 years? And or is there a role for humanoids in the factory as well?
I mean, I think there is always a role there. The big question when it comes to robots will be, what's the price point, right? And then I think you will also see the huge differences in geographies. Obviously, a robot has a different ROI when you're deployed in Switzerland or in North America than when you're deployed in Asia.
Okay, thank you very much. Closing off, tell us about your team. We heard where you are based, but maybe you have other locations. Are you looking for talent? And if so, maybe there's one or the other listener interested. What should they bring?
Yeah, so we're always looking for exceptional talent with a background in AI, background in manufacturing or commercial folks in go-to-market. We are basically hiring across all these functions. Our team is based in Zurich and in New York City. We have a dual headquarters system. And we are working around the globe. We recently onboarded first factories in Africa. We are having deployments in Asia, in all of the Americas. So it's quite exciting. And we are looking really for people who can help us with software engineering, AI, customer integration, commercial sales. So if anyone is interested, please feel free to go on our website, ethan.com, or drop me a message on LinkedIn.
Bernhard, thank you very much. It was really interesting hearing from you what you're doing today and where you see the market moving. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a really good conversation.